Welcome to another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. You know, we've reached another Friday on this show, and it feels to me like every Friday I start the show by saying virtually the same thing. It's been another consequential week in Georgia and, for that matter, in the United States. And once more, we have so much to talk about, and I'm very happy that to do that. I'm joined today by State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, who represents Decatur. She's also an attorney in Decatur. Mary Margaret, thank you so much for being here. You're getting set to go into session to finish, what, the last 11 days, I think, of this session starting on Monday?
Good morning. We start Monday morning at 10 a.m. I'm not sure where I'm supposed to sit when I come into the Capitol, but I'll be there at 10.
And I'm of course you will.
And masks are required, so I will be there with a mask on.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the legislation that you're going to be looking at starting next week. Edward Lindsay joins us. He, of course, a former state representative, represented the city of Atlanta, and now heads the Georgia practice. Edward, what do we call it? The Georgia what practice at Denton's, the world's largest law firm?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what do we call your the division you represent, you oversee, the Georgia Government Affairs Division, right? Public Policy. Okay, I'm still waking up. I apologize for that. Jim Galloway, by the way, is taking the day off, and we already miss him, but we're going to muddle through the show without Galloway today. All right, let's get started. Obviously, the big story in Georgia this week, it made headlines here and across the country, was the story about the confusion, the problems that came up in our primary election on Tuesday. You know, we've talked about it to some in some extensive ways this week already. But Mary Margaret and Edward, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on exactly what happened here. And let me preface this by saying one thing. We took great pains to make clear, both on Wednesday's and Thursday's show, that with all the horror stories about people who waited for 4 or 5 hours, polling places that didn't close until after midnight to make sure everybody got a chance to vote, that while that certainly happened, there were many polling places in many counties across the state that had no problems at all. That's true. But, Mary Margaret, that said, when one person has to wait 6 hours to cast a ballot, 5 hours to cast a ballot, even if many of us got in and out fairly quickly, that taints the election for all of us, it seems to me. So it doesn't seem to me you can simply say, oh, well, there are problems in a few places, but not in a lot of others. This means it's a problem for everyone who votes.
It is definitely a problem for everyone who votes. And the anxiety around voting this year exceeds anything I've ever experienced in my long political career. For us to say only isolated problems, or not us, but for the Secretary of State to say only isolated problems or only problems in DeKalb and Fulton is really a significant gap in his understanding of how upset people are. I'm very happy to report that I walked into my precinct in person Tuesday and there was no wait, and with some help from a staff, from a poll worker, I was able to vote easily, and it was a very smooth experience. One precinct over south of me, one precinct over west of me in Grady and around Oakhurst, the number of hours that people waited is simply unacceptable. There is no one who will say what happened on Tuesday was an acceptable rollout. And I've got a lot of thoughts about that, and I've got a lot of work on my desk in preparing for what the Speaker, David Ralston, has called for in the Government Affairs Committee, where I'm the senior Democrat in that committee, to do an investigation of what happened on Tuesday, June 9th.
Yeah, well, we're going to look forward to what your committee finds out. Edward?
Well, first of all, let me clarify one thing about Secretary of State Raffensperger. I don't think when he said that The problems were concentrated in a few counties. He was dismissing the seriousness of the issue, but he was trying to sort of pinpoint where changes needed to be made and fixes needed to be made. I don't believe he was in any way trying to intimate that it was okay for someone to have to wait 6 hours, or even more significantly, it was okay for some folks who had ordered their absentee ballots weeks in advance and never got them. I would divide the issue between two things. One is aggravating and the other is unacceptable. Aggravating is what someone who had to wait 6 hours to be able to vote, but still was able to vote. Aggravating is what I had to do when I had to wait 2 hours because my voting place in Fulton County didn't have the machines working for somewhere between 30 to 45 minutes. But unacceptable is when someone was denied their ability to vote. And, you know, what the Secretary of State was trying to do was sort of say, look, we need to sort of focus on where the problems existed in the state and see what we need to do to fix it. And there are a lot of things to fix it. I'm very happy that the Speaker of the House is taking this on and recognizes that this is a problem. There is plenty of blame to go around between different folks who are in charge of the election process, both at the state and the county level. The question is, what are they going to collectively do from this point forward to get us through a smooth runoff in mid-August and then a general election, which is, given the turnout last Tuesday, we can almost guarantee will be a record turnout in Georgia. There is enormous issues involved here, given, you know, and then you have the overlay of the pandemic that we're having to deal with. You're going to have a record number of people seeking to vote by mail, and, you know, we need to put together the necessary infrastructure to allow for that. We're going to need to, quite frankly, to train our poll workers, a lot of whom are going to be new because a lot of the older poll workers are worried about coming back to do what they used to do because of their fear of the pandemic. And we're going to have to make sure that these brand new machines operate correctly because Mary Margaret is right. We cannot have either in August or November what we saw 3 days ago.
Mary Margaret, you know, it's interesting. I've been giving a lot of thought, and then you actually were watched Kathy Cox, Secretary of State, back at the turn of the 2000s, talk about this the other day. Melita Easters of the Georgia Windlist had a conversation with her, a web conversation with her. We all remember that in 2002, when we switched, became the first state in the country to go to computer balloting, we didn't have a pandemic for sure. But the training was far more extensive from the state level to county level. The glitches were more minimal. There was an enormous amount of communication that went to voters via TV news stories, commercials, that sort of thing. That transition happened relatively seamlessly. Yes, there were added problems this time with the virus. Nevertheless, when the Secretary of State's people tried to say, well, this is a county problem, we did everything right, the fact of the matter is, everybody's got to figure out a way to work together and stop the finger pointing.
Voting in Georgia is a shared partnership between the Secretary of State and locals, and that partnership has failed. The most helpful information I got this week from Kathy Cox, who went through the implementation of computer machines for the first time. I was running in 2002 to come back into politics after I'd been out for a while. So I was watching that closely along the campaign trail, the controversy around her, the focus on her. There was a group of citizens who were just totally apoplectic about not having paper ballots. And in effect, that issue has reemerged in 2020. But the most interesting thing to me is that her contract with the vendor that she purchased the machines from required the vendor to do the training. And the contract, as she said in her interview this week, required specific training by the vendor in every precinct of at least two poll workers. In addition to that, the contract provided that the vendor had specific tech obligations. there had to be a tech support, vendor-supported person in every county of the 159 counties we have. That is a big element of a contract. Further, she said she had on election day, this was her staff, 107 staff people out in the state, so that there would be a ratio of Secretary of State staff on the ground throughout Georgia that would be immediately available.
All right, I got to jump. Mary Margaret, I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut you off. I have got to jump in, as you know. And so we're going to take a break right now, and I apologize for interrupting, but let's do that, and we'll come back and continue our conversation. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Edward Lindsay, Mary Margaret Oliver, who, by the way, teach Sunday school together at their church, and so are good friends, despite the fact that one is a Republican and the other a Democrat. And that's one of the reasons we like so much having them on this show, because they have different views, but they really talk about them with a lot of kindness and respect for one another's point of view. All right, I'd like to move on past the election for right now, because we're going to be talking about it a lot in the weekend. And by the way, Rob Pitts, one of the longest-serving elected official, African-American elected officials in the state of Georgia, will be our guest on Monday's show. He's now chair of the Fulton County Commission. He wants to dig into what happened in Fulton County, and we'll also talk to him about discussion of race that is going on in this country right now and how important it's become. All right, let's move on. Edward Lindsay, last night the governor, I think, surprised a lot of people by continuing to lift restrictions for the shelter-in-place rules that he had ordered a month ago. Among them, people up to 50 people can gather without social distancing requirements being necessary. Concerts can start again on July 1st. Live entertainment venues, they're going to have to follow specific rules. For groups larger than 50 people, the governor says you still have to have social distancing of 6 feet apart. He's going to expand restaurant in-dining regulations so that people can do that more comfortably. The shelter in place for people over 65, unless they're medically fragile, is lifted as well. Edward, and at the same time, you know, Georgia's been spared, Edward, what surrounding states have seen in terms of huge spikes in the weeks since lifting their restrictions. And we've been very fortunate, but we're starting to see our numbers go up a bit more. So far, the governor's won this risk, this gamble, but how concerned should we be that we may face another spike, Edward?
Well, we should be concerned, and I believe that the governor has put into place calls still for folks to maintain social distancing, to still be cautious, to still make sure you wash your hands, to use a mask, you know, when out in public and close to other people. And this is going to be a one-step-at-a-time process for the next probably 12 to 18 months. But, you know, you have to balance that against the folks' willingness or ability to stay sheltered and to keep the economy shut down. There's only so much you can do before people have a, you know, feel like they need to get out and be able to run their lives. The question is, are folks going to be able to do so responsibly? And therein is going to be the lie of the question. While the restrictions have been eased, the question is, will people act responsibly? If they will, I think that we will continue to have at least a flattening of any curve so that the health community can take care of those more serious cases. And if folks don't, whether it be at a concert, whether it be at a beach, or whether it be at a protest at the Capitol, then we're going to have to come back in and impose greater restrictions. So the question is, are we going to act responsibly with this additional freedom that we're given underneath this pandemic?
Mary Margaret?
I think we're feeling our way and with facts that we don't know. I'm confused by what the rule says the governor issued yesterday about restaurants. You know, we have 50 small restaurants in Decatur. It's a major part of our of our community. It's a major part of our small business environment, and they are not all going to survive. Today's paper tells me that the governor has lifted all restrictions on the number of people that can sit in a restaurant or distancing of tables. I'm just not sure that we know what the rules are going to be at this point. And the fact that the national forecaster that most people have been relying upon, the epidemiology crowd out of the University of Washington, now says that we're going to have 170,000 deaths by, I think he said, October, is pretty chilling information. We don't know what's going to happen with the virus. The states around us are having a spiking of new cases. I hope that Georgia will not have a spike, but I believe we're facing a lot of unknowns. I do not know what it means that you can have a, quote, convention or conference of 50 people and have no social distancing. I don't know what that means in terms of a practical application.
Well, in fact, conventions can come in much larger numbers if they abide by a number of restrictions and rules that the state is putting in place. So I don't have those in front of me at this moment, so I can't tell you about them. But they are opening business back up for conventions to come in. We're going to have to get to another break in a minute, Mary Margaret, but I do want to say, because Edward Lindsay really made the point here, you're where the rubber meets the road starting next week in terms of the balance between keeping people safe and getting the economy started again, because you are going to grapple as a member of the Appropriations Committee with this tremendously difficult budget that we have to deal with given the revenue drops the state has seen. So, in fact, you're going to face this in ways that a lot of us out there are just watching.
The only statutory duty we have in our remaining 11 days is to pass a budget, and that budget starts July 1st of 2020. That's our fiscal year 21 budget that starts in less than 3 weeks. And the governor's changed his 14% reduction to maybe he's changed it to 11% reduction, so we're having a new round. But I'm very, very concerned about this budget. And the questions that we don't know yet, I don't know yet, how much are we going to get from the federal stimulus package that's being debated now, and will we know in the next 2 weeks? Two, how much are our revenues coming up? They're coming up some. We're measuring it daily. And the reserves, how much of the reserves are we going to get?
We're going to watch the budget hearing, budget hearings very closely. We got to take another break. When we come back, Edward and Mary Margaret, I want to talk about one of the other big issues that we're going to see develop at the remainder of the session starting next week, and that's whether hate crimes legislation advances through the Senate and actually passes to go to the governor's desk. We will do that, and we'll come back and continue our conversation. Hey, Edward Lindsay, I got a quick piece of breaking news for you, and then I want to talk about hate crimes. Mary Margaret, this is for you, too. Greg Bluestein is reporting just now that in the 7th District congressional race, the Democratic race, which we thought was headed to a rundown, Carolyn Bordeaux, who, of course, won the Democratic nomination last time out and lost by narrow margin to Rob Woodall, is coming closer to an outright win. Her folks, her supporters, of which you're one, Mary Margaret, think that absentee ballot trends suggest that Carolyn Bordeaux may actually become the Democratic nominee without a runoff up there. We'll obviously be talking more about that in the days and weeks ahead. But let's talk hate crimes for a little while. Edward Lindsay, during your tenure in the General Assembly, certainly there was a call for hate crimes legislation, usually advanced by Democrats, never got very far. Now, the Republican House passed that legislation last year. It's in the Senate right now, and there's pressure in the entire business community for the Senate to take action. Are we going to get a hate crimes bill passed this year, do you believe, Edward?
I think there's a fairly good chance. There's a lot of work that needs to be done between now and then. In the interest of full disclosure, let me tell you that I represent the Anti-Defamation League. And my firm has signed on to the letter from the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce advocating for its passage. So I'm a great believer in it. And quite frankly, I consider this part of my unfinished business when I left the General Assembly, because I did advocate for it when I was there, but we weren't able to get it passed. Like you said, it passed out of the House, Mary Margaret's House, last year. It's now in the Senate. It's enjoying some strong support from the Lieutenant Governor. The question is, what will it look like when it passes out of the Senate? The Speaker and the author of the bill, Republican Representative Chuck Evstration, have asked that the bill pass out of the Senate with no changes, so that it doesn't need any further action by the House. The Senate has indicated that it does want to sort of tinker with it. The question is, what will it look like? You know, if there are some folks on both ends of the political spectrum that want to either add to it or detract from it. I certainly don't want to see any of the protections that are contained within the hate crimes bill taken out by the Senate. And I've received repeated assurances from the Lieutenant Governor's office and from various members of the leadership that that won't happen. There are some other folks that want to see some things added to it, given what's happened in Georgia and around the country recently. The concern there is that some of these issues are complicated, and while they should certainly be addressed, probably the biggest one would be the citizen's arrest issue. That's something that's going to need to be sort of worked through over the next 6 months or next January. And, you know, what I and a lot of other folks want is, let's get this piece of legislation passed. Georgia's only one of four states of the country that don't have it, and we need it. Let's get this passed, and then move forward to the next step.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Mary Margaret, here's what's interesting about this. House members have said those Republicans over in the Senate are holding this thing up. It's time they just pass this out. Your speaker has called for a clean bill. But now there's Democrats on the Senate side who want to load the bill up with things beyond the basic hate crimes bill itself, with things like stopping citizens' arrests, stand your ground laws. So now you've got Democrats on the Senate side who could slow this down and prevent it from getting through if there can't be a compromise between what could be competing versions of the bill.
The Senate has had the hate crimes bill, House Bill 426, for 460 days. And everybody claims that they want to pass it, and yet it hasn't passed. 460 days. I am spending a good amount of my time on the repeal of the citizen's arrest statute, a total anachronistic bad policy that seems to encourage vigilantism. And there is no reason to wait till January to repeal citizen's arrest. There are multiple other vehicles that the General Assembly could apply our attention to deal with citizen's arrest or stand your ground. Hate crimes has to pass. And the phenomena of the Senate doing nothing, my definition of nothing, because they haven't passed anything for 460 days, puts them in a position of limited credibility, in my view. If they want to pass a hate crimes bill, then vote on it and pass it back. I don't have a strong opinion whether or not the Senate should strengthen the hate crimes bill, which I personally would do if I were writing it myself. But I do have a strong opinion that this dithering is simply a camouflage for some other political conversations that are happening behind the scenes. There are Senate Republican leaders who do not want to include gay people as protection against discrimination. And that is a totally unacceptable conversation to be having in 2020. So I am.
Edward, I got to get to a.
Yeah.
Finish up your comment.
My comment on that is.
Go ahead, Edward.
I agree with Mary Margaret that the protection of the LGBTQ community should be included in the bill. We've received repeated assurances that that portion of the bill will remain in it by key members of the Republican leadership. The key here, though, is not to burden it with so many extraneous things that we make it difficult to pass in the next 11 days. Mary Margaret is right. It's passed by the House last year. It's sitting in the Senate this year. She and I both have been in the process long enough to know that it's often what happens. The question here is whether or not it gets done by the end of the next 11 legislative days. And my focus is not going to be pointing fingers, but to try to get everyone to hold hands, sing kumbaya, and get this thing passed.
All right. I've got to get to another break. And by the way, I apologize for having interrupted you, Mary Margaret. I've interrupted you, Edward. And I do apologize for that. It's all part of this working remotely. And I do my best to be respectful of all of you. So I apologize if I've interrupted a couple of times. All right. Back with Mary Margaret Oliver and Edward Lindsay. First, let me just say thank you so much for those of you who have said nice things about Political Rewind. You really are an extraordinary audience, and the relationship that I feel like we've all developed through years now of talking about big issues is so important to me, and I just want you to know that you mean a great deal to me. And I'm glad you think well of the show, too. All right. We've only got a few minutes left. Mary Margaret, let me start with you. You're the Democrat on the panel today. John Ossoff wins the Democratic Senate nomination without a runoff. He will face David Perdue in November. How important is it that he was able to do this without facing what could have been a very difficult runoff election?
It's a huge, huge benefit to the Ossoff campaign. I'm very happy for him. He has surprised everybody at every turn. The number of votes he got exceeding a very well-qualified candidate, Teresa Tomlinson, is simply surprising. And it would reflect, which is positive for the Democrats and positive for him, is that young people are coming out to vote and that he has excited a new base of voters. When I saw the film of people standing in line in DeKalb at Fulton County for 2 to 6 hours, it looked to me like young people. And it looked to me like those are folks that are excited to vote for John Ossoff. I'm proud of him. I've known him since he was a child. His family has been active civically all around my territories, and I'm very proud of his success. Congratulations, John.
Edward, a lot has been made of the fact that not long ago, David Perdue made the statement, this race is up for grabs. This is not a given that we're going to win. Well, you know, and so people took that at face value. If you're an incumbent, you don't want to say to people, don't worry about it. I'm going to win this thing. So I'm not sure we should make a lot about Perdue's statement, but maybe this race really is in play.
It is in play, as shown by the primary results, which are promising for Senator Perdue in that the total number of votes he received were 723,000, and the total number of votes that were cast in the Democratic with U.S. Senate primary were 707,000. So he does show that he does have an edge here, but it's an extremely competitive race, and Senator Perdue is quite wise to take this seriously. Georgia is going to be competitive on the presidential level, on the U.S. Senate level with two U.S. Senate races, and all the way down to the General Assembly races and local races. And I don't think the Republicans are going to be caught napping here. They know it's competitive. They are working hard to get their base activated as well. And I add to congratulations to Mr. Ossoff. He beat some very well-qualified Democrats without a runoff. But now he's facing someone who is formidable, who has a great resume in terms of his success before he got into politics. And we'll see what happens in November.
Mary Margaret, the fate of a John Ossoff and other Democrats on the ticket to some extent will depend on how invested the presidential campaign of Joe Biden decides to come into Georgia and really invest heavily on winning this state. And there's some question as to whether the Biden people are going to want to do that because it's still a risky proposition.
I have hard to believe that the Biden folks would not come to Georgia, given the fact that we have two Senate seats. What I'm watching closely is what is Plan B for Senator Perdue? What's Plan B for Lindsey next door in terms of what terrible thing the president's going to do tomorrow? What is the president going to do tomorrow that's today or tomorrow that's going to require David Perdue to finally say something that communicates to Georgians that there's simply behaviors that he's not going to support. David Perdue's success is tied to President Trump. President Trump's approval ratings down into the 30s. And I don't know what the president's going to say or do tomorrow, but the Republican leaders of this state and nationally have to have a plan B in mind if the president's approval rating contends to be in the 30s. If I were David Perdue, I would be very worried, A, about what the president's going to be doing tomorrow, far more than I'd be worried about how many millions of dollars Joe Biden's going to put into Georgia. Georgia is at play. Everybody knows that.
Edward, I think you're going to end up with the last word on this. It is certainly true that David Perdue's press office, at least, has not been cranking out a lot of releases as they used to about how David Perdue supports this thing the president has done or said, that thing the president has said or done. He's gone a little dark in terms of talking about his giving his praise to the president lately.
Well, I think the president can stand on his own and should stand on his own. He's got his election to run, and Senator Perdue has his race to run. And Senator Perdue, I believe, has a strong record in the U.S. Senate fighting for various issues that I think are important to Georgians. He's running against a young man, a very nice young man. But let's face it, Don Ossoff, to borrow a phrase from Ann Richards, from a couple of decades ago, he was born on third base and acts like he hit a triple. So you're going to have someone with a proven business record in private life and a proven record in public life versus someone with a very thin resume. And I feel very good about the chances of Senator Perdue, but it is going to be competitive.
Mary Margaret, we are virtually out of time. You get about 20 seconds to respond to what you just heard Edward Lindsay say.
Georgia, is it play?
And I mean it, 20.
Georgia is at play. Georgia is at play. Everybody knows that. And next week for the General Assembly, the budget, citizens' arrest, and hate crimes is what's on my mind right now.
All right. Edward Lindsay, we're watching you on the WebEx that we use just to do internal communication. You just held up a Visa card clearly saying David Perdue has a money advantage that is going to really help him as he moves forward against John Ossoff. And certainly he has an enormous war chest. Thank you for that visual clue, Edward. That's it for today's Political Rewind. Mary Margaret Oliver, good luck starting on Monday with a legislative session. We'll have you back to talk about that sometime in the week or so ahead. Edward Lindsay, thank you so much for today's show. And all of you for listening. And again, thank you for the support you've given to this show and to me personally. I cannot tell you how much it means to me. So thank you for supporting us.